But I think what that mindset fails to provide is the perspective of like thinking before doing is usually the most important thing in creating your space. Like asking yourself, why did those things end up on the checklist? What is the most important thing on the checklist? Am I even doing the work that I want to be doing right now? Is this giving me energy? We were never taught to take time and space to think about any of those things.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Tim O'Brien, "Storytelling is the essential human activity." My guest today, Alex Lieberman, has excelled at bringing storytelling to the business world. He's the co-founder and CEO of Morning Brew, a daily email newsletter that condenses business news into content that appeals to a younger audience. Lieberman started Morning Brew as a college student in 2015, grew it to over 3 million subscribers, and sold a majority stake to Business Insider. He's also the host of the popular podcast Founders Journal. Alex, welcome. It's great to have you on the Elevate Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I've heard you talk before about how it was a childhood dream to work at Morgan Stanley. Usually it's like baseball player,
astronaut, you know, so architect. Astronaut,
yeah. It's a very specific childhood dream. So I heard you came from a family of traders, I guess. So how was there family at Morgan Stanley? How'd you pick that one? And how did that finance sort of desire develop early on?
Yeah. So, you know, the way that I think about it is there were a few values that my family instilled in me at a very young age. One of them was the importance that all of us would place on family. Like family is the number one thing. And I feel like throughout life, your aperture just continues to open up, right? Yeah. You continue to be aware of more and more things. And at a young age, I didn't have a very wide aperture because most of my life had been lived actually through my parents' experiences, through what they were telling me. Only as you continue to live life does your aperture open up because you experience life for yourself.
I just had a vision of you in like first grade dress up career day showing up in the suit with a, you know, Gordon Gekko, when everyone else is there.
You're not far off. You're not far off. My parents like to dress me up in pretty ridiculous stuff growing up. I'm pretty sure my first day of a new school I went to, they dressed me up in a sweater vest. They dressed me up for Halloween. My dad was like very into dressing me up as the things that he wanted me to be versus what I wanted to be. So I was dressed as Groucho Marx one year. I was dressed as Blue Man Group, Einstein, not the typical Halloween costumes for kids. But anyway, I was, you know, family was everything to me. My family all worked in the same industry in financial services. My dad was a trader for Citigroup. My mom was a salesperson for Nomura. My grandpa was in fixed income for Prudential. So it's like, again, at that point in time when my aperture was small, I didn't know anything else existed.
So how'd you pick Morgan Stanley?
I didn't actually pick Morgan Stanley. Oh, okay. My dream was to be a trader.
Got it.
And so I was like, that's what my dad does. That's what I have to do. I want to be the best trainer in the world. And that's what I had written on my whiteboard growing up. Morgan Stanley came later once I started having internships in college. But honestly, I didn't even know the firms. I was just like, I need to do exactly what my family is doing because they're my superheroes. I want to be like my superheroes. And there wasn't much more thought to that because I didn't know what I didn't know about what I could do that actually may have been more fulfilling to me.
My dad was a lawyer. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. I interned at two law firms in college and I absolutely hated it. So yeah,
makes sense.
That's what you do. So were you into business in high school? What did you study? What did you focus on before you went to Michigan?
Yeah. So high school was, it was a very interesting time for me. I found actually high school to be kind of challenging. In a lot of ways, I found it challenging academically because I always was a very specific type of worker. I'm a very distracted person. Like I've talked about this on my podcast before, but like the way that I operate, my brain works in sprints where I'm really effective for like 20 minutes or 25 minutes. And then I need a break and a recharge, then another 25. And I think the high school format in general isn't really conducive to that way of thinking or working because my typical high school day was a 35-minute drive to high school because I went to a school, 10 towns over. Yeah. And we get to school at like 8:30, would wake up at 6:45, would get home from school at like 7. And so like I didn't have the luxury of choice to be able to spread my work out over many hours to be conducive to the way that I thought and the way that I approached work. And so basically I found it very difficult to work within the constraints of a high school schedule. I also was the youngest person in my grade, or one of the youngest. I went to the small private school, 120 people in my graduating class. And most people redid a year when they went to our school. And so I was one of the youngest. And I think what that meant for me is developmentally, I found it to be pretty difficult. Like I was at a school where it felt like everyone was the person who got a 2300 on their SAT, you know, got a full ride scholarship to an Ivy League school to play a sport, and was like the most social person on planet Earth. And so as someone who is young, underdeveloped, still trying to find themselves, I found it to be particularly challenging. On the flip side, like the positive of that was, I think I was pushed more in high school than in any kind of other part of my life. I found high school to be far more challenging than college, actually. So from an academic and an athletic perspective, high school was amazing. In terms of the stuff that, like, in high school, you really didn't have a focus, but, you know, what I remember being kind of my favorite classes were stats and econ, which again, I find interesting because also I consider myself to be more of a creative person. And so I would actually, if I had to guess, there probably actually were creative classes I took in school, like photography, that if I had given myself the opportunity to enjoy them, I could have actually enjoyed them better, because I think that's my natural way of thinking and the things that naturally give me energy.
Yeah. It sounds like a high achieving high school. I mean, I just watched the Varsity Blues thing. Yep. Like it's not a great environment that we've created, you know, making everyone think that getting into college is the be all and end all in life.
100%.
Yeah. All right. So you went to school. Did you major in business?
So the way it works in Michigan is there's two ways you can get into the business school. You can be a pre-admit. I wasn't good enough in high school grade-wise to become a pre-admit. So the other way is you apply during your freshman year. If you get in, you're in the business school from sophomore year to senior year. So went into college with no major. I was just in like the School of Literature Arts and the Sciences. And you have to take the prerequisite classes to be able to apply to the business school. I think there were calculus, stats, econ, and a few others. Ended up getting into the business school. And so then sophomore year to senior year, I majored in business administration. Focuses or concentrations was a very loose term in school. Like some schools, you have to take exact classes to have a concentration. For us, it was just you say what your concentration is.
Yeah.
So my concentration was like real estate and financial markets, because those were where I took most of my elective classes. And yeah, I majored in business.
Still on the banking track at that point?
Still on the sales and trading track. Yeah. So I interned after freshman year, sophomore year, junior year in financial services. Freshman year was for a financial services startup called bonds.com. Sophomore year was for Morgan Stanley and their wealth management practice. And then junior year was for Morgan Stanley in like their on the main sales and trading floor in Times Square, where their main building was. And yeah, I was full steam ahead, planet, like for me, peak.
So that you got that, I mean, that was the vision. So did you like it? Did you like that internship, or did it?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, memory is a really funny thing, because it's like, did I like it? Well, my memory is I liked it. Is it possible that I liked it because I had told myself for the prior 18 years of my life that I had to like it? That's also possible. Yeah. So did I like it? Well, I liked it enough, or I convinced myself that I liked it enough to not re-recruit for anything senior year and take a full-time job in sales and trading after school. You know, if I'm being honest, I don't think I knew what I liked. I think I still am trying to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up. What I did like about it was I liked that I was surrounded by really smart people. I think the way it typically works is industries that pay probably too much for their workers generally attract high IQ individuals. Yeah. And the reason I create that distinction is I found that people were really smart. The people on my desk that I worked with immediately were really good people. But in general, I think also when you get into industries where you have really smart people, I was talking about this with someone recently, just even in the startup space, EQ. I think sometimes IQ and EQ are inversely correlated. And so like worked with a lot of really smart people, but a lot of like really just not good people, not well-valued people. And to be totally honest with you, I've found some of that in the startup space also, with both investors and with founders. Luckily, I found some amazing people, like really big hearts that love to learn, that are also super accomplished. But I have found that in kind of these industries that offer outsized returns to people, IQ and EQ tend to be inversely correlated, and you tend to find a concentration of those people in industries like financial services or entrepreneurship.
So you're on this path, but then you started this newsletter. What was the genesis, and what year did it actually get started?
Yeah. So after my junior year internship with Morgan Stanley, was lucky enough, I got a job offer, accepted that job offer. I didn't even think twice about it. I just accepted it and went back to Michigan. And I didn't have to re-recruit for a job. I only had to take 3 classes my whole senior year. So I had all of this free time. Great. And it was basically like, what can I do to keep myself sharp so that when I graduate from college, like my brain is situated in a way that I can actually do my job well. And so I started helping students prepare for job interviews, because a lot of students did re-recruit their senior year for other jobs. And in those like prep conversations, I would usually do mock interviews with students, and I would ask students, you know, how do you keep up with the business world? That was always the question I would ask. And their answer would always be something to the effect of, you know, I read the Wall Street Journal. I would say why. They would say, because my parents told me that I have to, and because it's a prerequisite to say I'm well read in business. And then they would go on about like, but it's dense, it's dry, I can't get through the whole journal cover to cover. And at some point I was like, this is crazy. These kids are working their asses off to have careers in business, yet they don't have content that gets them excited about a career where they're going to spend 50% of their waking hours in that industry. It sounds wild that they don't have content that gets them excited about that. And so I started writing a daily business roundup at the time called Market Corner. I would spend 4 hours a day just like peruse it, like basically reading the internet, the primary business news sources. So Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Reuters, Financial Times, The Economist, et cetera. And it would take what I thought were the most important stories in the business world for the college business student. I would curate them and then rewrite them in 50 to 150 word blurbs. And then I would add kind of like this, let's call it like business complementary stuff for the reader. So like,
would you link to the original post? Was it more of a synopsis of it, or was it you were just re-reporting whatever the news was?
It was a re-reporting for you to know like really the bare bones of what happened and why, right? And no, there wasn't a clickable link because it wasn't even in email format at the time. It was in a PDF. I literally would write this in a Microsoft Word template, then convert it to a PDF, and then attach the PDF to an email that I would send out to a listserv. The listserv was marketcorner@umich.edu. The first one went out to like 35 or 40 people, the people I was prepping for job interviews, the people I lived with on campus, a few people in my family. And then it just grew little by little, brick by brick. And the reason I felt so much excitement about this is interesting, there's appetite for it, is because it was impossible to sign up and it wasn't that great of a product. There was no website. You had to email me or text me to say, hey, can you add me to your listserv?
Right. So if people are willing to go through that many hoops.
Then, if you would go through that many hoops, like, and there's so much business news already out there, clearly it's satisfying something that current business news doesn't serve. And so it grew little by little. At some point, I sent out an email when I was feeling really encouraged about it saying, hey, if you're a reader and you want to help me grow this thing, create more content, take it to the next level, reach out to me. And I got an email from this guy, Austin Reif. He was one of the people that emailed me. And he said, hey, I have ideas for how Market Corner can be better. Still have the email thread saved on my desktop. And I said, okay, sounds good. Let's meet up in the Winter Garden, which is the name of the main lobby in the business school at Michigan. And I said, let's meet up in the Winter Garden and we'll talk about it to see if you know, to see if you're willing to give the time commitment that this needs. which is ironic in retrospect, given it's my co-founder. And now Austin, you know, I've recently moved into the executive chairman role. Austin is the CEO of Morning Brew now. And like, it's just funny at the time that I phrased it as, let's see if you're willing to give the commitment to this. But the reason that I ended up partnering up with him at the time, not really as like a co-founder. Yes, he had the name co-founder, but we weren't thinking about it as a business. This was just like a fun side gig. The reason I even wanted to bring him on for whatever this was he was a very different type of thinker than I was. Like I described my way of thinking to you a few minutes ago. I'm a creative. I think of a lot of ideas. Like my default brain is always to like, what are new and interesting things we can do for the user? How do we market it? How do we scale the audience?
You're a tinkerer. You're always messing with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Austin is very much like, he's more of like a finance thinker. He's an analytic. He is a linear thinker. He is an operational mind. And so to me, it was really cool having someone around me that said stuff in such a like direct and focused way. Like he was born as like the racehorse with the blinders. I need to create context in my life to have the blinders.
Yeah.
And so it was really cool to have someone complimentary like that with me.
With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
You know, there's one thing you said before it occurred to me, it tied to our earlier conversation too, that you know, you talk about going to the high school where you're in all these classes and AP and high achievement, you know, going to Michigan, and then you only have three classes senior year, right? And then, and with that space, you look around, think about what you like, solve a problem. Like, you know, some people would say, and I was even going to joke, oh, well, how do your parents feel about paying $6,000 for three classes? But that space is actually what created the room to think.
Totally.
So the way that we're, you know, the education, just stacking people so busy and so overwhelmed, you end up on that track that you were saying before because you don't have any time to step off the track and even look at it. And I just, yeah, it seems like, I don't know, that was an interesting lesson in there.
I think also school incentivizes you because of the stack of work to do. To constantly do, like do, like check this thing, this assignment off, then write this essay with a 4-day deadline. And I think it actually creates a really bad habit of like what it means to be productive.
Right.
I think we are all programmed to be obsessed with checklists and feeling really good about ourselves when we check things off a checklist.
100%.
But I think what that mindset fails to provide is the perspective of like thinking before doing is usually the most important thing in creating your space. Like asking yourself, why did those things end up on the checklist? What is the most important thing on the checklist? Am I even doing the work that I want to be doing right now? Is this giving me energy? We were never taught to take time and space to think about any of those things.
Yeah. When you're studying, I mean, they said, you know, the notion of a shower idea, or like, this is all because you're not using your active brain. I've had tons of breakthroughs when I'm traveling, when I'm somewhere else, where I'm just out of the routine. And yeah, it's interesting that, you know, I think sometimes that stuff is just seen as soft, but people need the space.
Exactly. And I think that's why it's even really important for businesses to somehow craft a culture of giving people permission to stop and just like, you know, take walking meetings or walk around or just like do things that put you into a form of autopilot that actually allow you to get your best thoughts because you don't constantly have to be in this, like, you know, chugging along, like literally in the forest where you can't see the trees type of way of working.
No, it's interesting. So, all right, well, fast back forward. So you get this started, you meet Alex, like what?
Austin.
Austin, sorry.
Alex.
Yeah. what was the tipping point, the sort of Malcolm Gladwell tipping point that when it really started to go and you knew, like, what was the thing you did where it caught fire?
Yeah, I think the two that stand out to me was the first time that I saw someone reading Morning Brew who wasn't in my immediate circle. So being on a subway in New York, going to work and seeing a random person in a suit sitting down, scrolling through the brew, that was a pretty amazing point in time. It was a time that told me that people actually read this that aren't my grandma or someone who knows my grandma.
Yeah.
The second time was when we completed this circle. That was like, you know, basically the circle of life that we focused on for the first 3 years of the business around just our newsletter, where we said, okay, we have this newsletter. It's nice, but how do we make it an actual business? Well, there are three steps that really define any media company, but let's focus on it with our newsletter. Step one is create great content, like the best content, for our specific audience, right? So create the best daily business read for the modern business leader, bar none. Feel great that we're doing that. Step two, acquire modern business leaders who can now read the content we've created for them. And step three, monetize that audience, which in our case was through advertising. So convince some of the biggest brands in the world, maybe not the biggest brands in the world, just brands who have marketing dollars, why they should pay us to get in front of the modern business leader. And it was in 2018 to 2019 that we completed that three-step cycle. And what completing that three-step cycle did is not only prove to us that we had a business, but it also allowed us to reinvest in our business. Because then by securing advertising deals, we finally were actually driving revenue that we could reinvest into the business. We reinvested it in two ways, either by hiring more people to be tasked to different parts of this cycle, or by spending on paid marketing. And by spending on paid marketing, we accelerated Morning Brew's size in a year faster than we could have done it in, you know, 5 years if we didn't have that circle spinning. So we went from 100,000 readers to 1 million readers in 12 months by having this content, growth, sales, and then reinvest into paid marketing cycle going for that year.
But I've heard you say that you thought you benefited. You know, if you had raised $10 million, you probably would have spent a lot of it in the wrong areas, that you benefited by having constraints earlier on and just having to be creative and getting the word out there and figuring out how to get this on other campuses and how to do that without a lot of money. I actually think constraints drive creativity. It's easy to spend a ton of money, right? Yep.
I think they're just totally different skills, right? So I think by being constrained, it forced us to figure out how can we grow without just pouring money into it. So I think it forced us to have discipline.
Had you had the money at the time, would you have spent it on the right thing?
No, we wouldn't have known how to spend it.
Yeah,
and right. So I think that's a totally different skill in itself, which is a valuable skill, but you need kind of both of them. You need the skill set of being prudent with your money and being creative when your back's against the wall. And then you need the skill of, once you're doing well, once there is a fair bit of money, how do you allocate it in the right way? How do you place bets in the right way? How do you move capital in the right way to give yourself the best chance of long-term success?
I assume early on, everyone who worked, when was it a business? Was everyone working for free for you for the first year or two?
So we were a business starting in 2017.
Okay.
So 2015 to 2017, we were not a business. It was a side project that, you know, starting in June of 2015, I was at Morgan Stanley. I was doing this on the side. Austin was still a student because he's 2 years younger than me.
Oh, wait. So you actually went and took the job.
Yeah, I took the job after graduating. I graduated from Michigan, June of 2015. I went to Morgan Stanley for training July of 2015. I left Morgan Stanley September of 2016. So just over a year later. And basically what happened is when I joined Morgan Stanley, I was no longer allowed to be involved in the writing of the newsletter because I was at a financial services firm and they thought it would be a conflict of interest. Austin couldn't write it because he was a full-time student. So then what ended up happening was we had an editor who was still a student at Michigan, who had this nice balance of being in the business school, but was a writer for the school newspaper. We ended up recruiting somewhere between 6 and 10 college students to write the newsletter. People who wrote it for free wanted to just get their writing in front of 5 to 10,000 people.
You gave them attribution credit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The editor who I just mentioned kind of like oversaw their writing schedule. And it was basically that. It was like a college student written product from 2015 to basically back end of 2016. We made our first hire at the end of 2016, which was a writer. And that's when like the business actually started. That's when we raised a small round of capital from friends and family. That's when we made our first hire. That's when I went full-time. Austin went full-time in June of 2017. So it's like end of 2016, beginning of 2017 it went from side project and like nice audience project to an actual business.
And what was the decision to leave work? Was it a chicken and egg? Like it was getting so big that you needed to, or you just decided it wasn't going to get big if you didn't?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of a few things. I think one, I felt like I was diluting my abilities. I felt like I was doing a B-minus job at work and a B-minus job at Morning Brew because I was doing two things and it was impossible to work hard enough at either of them to be really good. So I knew there was going to be a natural fork in the road. Morning Brew was giving me a ton more energy.
Yeah.
Despite only, you know, spending my last few hours of the day on it each day, I knew that I would way more regret not doing Morning Brew and seeing someone else go and build it because they just were willing to put in the time. That scenario looked way worse to me than me going and doing Morning Brew and it failing. And then there was also the kind of the perspective that like my dad passed away a week before junior year of college suddenly. And I think there was an aspect where I was like kind of scared shitless to be doing the same job that he was doing for 20 years. Like I was trading mortgages. He had traded mortgages for 20 years. And I was like, is this literally going to be Groundhog Day? And then I think there was a second part of it where it was just like kind of a switch went off in my head, which was like, I could literally drop dead at any moment. Doesn't matter what health I have. Like stuff happens in life. I watched it before my eyes. I can't allow any sort of like concern around uncertainty stop me from doing something that I'm really passionate about. I need to enjoy the work that I'm doing. And at the time, I was also like, now there's no breadwinner in the family. I kind of assumed some level of obligation, whether that it was rightfully so or not. I assumed some level of obligation to care for my family in some way. And to me, being an entrepreneur could offer an outsized return to literally take care of my family for the rest of my life in a way that being a trader at Morgan Stanley, while lucrative, could not.
It's funny because I would actually assume that the society or conventional wisdom would have told you the other thing, which is, you know, given that this happened, stay in a stable job, do that. Don't take that risk. You're great. Like it all, I think 9 out of 10 people would probably give you the opposite. The entrepreneur would tell you that, but 9 out of 10 people would be like, don't give up the stable job.
Yeah. I totally agree with you that would be the conventional wisdom. I wanted to enjoy what I was doing. I just wanted to enjoy the work that I was doing. And at the same time, I had kind of a naive confidence that there was something to this thing that could become big.
One of the ways I know that you scaled it, I know we're jumping around chronologically a little bit, but I think this is important for companies, again, who just in some ways are a little handcuffed by the money these days. It's like, oh, well, if I got to do it quickly and fast, I go to Facebook. But Facebook's costs are up 30, average price of an ad is up 30% in the last year. Yep. So it's getting harder and harder to make money. So you guys built this ambassador program that really, I think, got it moving in the early days. Could you walk through sort of how you came up with the idea for that? I know the term is around, but this, I think this really worked for you and is super cost effective.
Yeah. So basically it was just an evolution where at first we were like, how do we grow this thing when it was just Austin and I? The way we always prioritize is what we said, what is the warmest audience who already is going to know about Morning Brew or who is best positioned to sign up for it? And where's there a density of that audience? Like we thought about things in terms of like hub and spoke, right? So like, how can we get in front of the hub who has access to all of these spokes? like an example of a hub and spoke would be like social media. Social media hypothetically can get you in front of, you know, 3 billion devices. The feasible thing at the time was us going to clubs and classes on Michigan's campus that were business related and going in front of the class, pitching Morning Brew for a few minutes, passing around a sheet of paper, getting students to write down their email on a sheet of paper, and then us manually plugging in their emails. And so Austin and I started doing that. One, I think it just gave us a pretty good crash course in effective selling and storytelling. It also forced us to be a little bit uncomfortable by having to convince teachers why we should have 2 minutes of their class's time to sell something to students. But it was really effective. We got a couple thousand students on Michigan's campus signed up by doing this. We basically cleared out just like all of the business classes, all of the business clubs, and then anything tangentially related like econ, poli sci, et cetera. So we did this. And then Austin and I were like, okay, now what? We were like, well, we have Michigan covered. What about all the other schools? We were like, what about the other Big Ten schools? Like, who's going to do Michigan State, Ohio State, Penn State, et cetera? We're like, okay, we need to find the Austin and Alex at those schools. So then we used our email list, emailed like in our newsletter saying, hey, if you want to be an ambassador for Morning Brew, hit us up. People reached out to us. We made them ambassadors, literally gave them the exact playbook we did at Michigan where we gave them templates.
And they weren't paid, right?
No, they were paid in love and swag.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's one of those things where it's like the early days of the startup, like your first 1,000 to 10,000 customers just want to be a part of it. They yeah. really just want to be a part of the journey. We actually tested at one point paying ambassadors and it didn't do as well.
They preferred the sweatshirt.
Yeah, actually, like it made things more transactional. Yeah. When things became transactional, no longer was fun for them. It was a job.
And at the time, they could see it wasn't like you were making a lot of money or we had all these advertisers. Yeah, so it was a movement. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then we convinced students at other schools to do this. That was doing well. It would bring in like, I don't know, 5,000 to 10,000 readers a semester. And then Austin and I were like, okay, we've done some schools. What about other people? Like, what about anyone who wants to share the brew with people, not just like a dedicated ambassador program that we're putting our time into? That's what led us to a just general referral program. And the way we started with our referral program is there was like an out-of-the-box solution called Kickoff Labs that we had built. We basically moved our website to there and it allowed you to have it where anytime someone signed up for the newsletter by putting their email address in, they would get a unique referral link. And when they shared that link, they would get certain rewards. We quickly found that like that solution wasn't very flexible. Yeah. So then we did research online. We had found that the kind of whole playbook that Harry's Razors had used at launch when they were building their referral program, because they had a really successful referral program to build up a massive waiting list for Harry's when it launched.
Yeah.
We ended up going on Upwork, finding a freelance engineer based out of Ohio saying, this Harry's Razors thing, can you do that, exactly that for us, but just put like our logo on instead of Harry's? And that's what he did for $500. He built effectively like our new landing page with a database that would intake people's emails and assign everyone a referral link. And then when they referred someone, it would make sure it was keeping count of their number of referrals. And that was the genesis of the referral program. And I don't know the exact number today, but hundreds of thousands of people have gotten at least one referral with Morning Brew, which means we've been able to spend more on paid marketing because we know that every subscriber is worth a little bit more than one subscriber. Because the odds are, you know, one out of every 10 subscribers will get at least one referral. And that's been massive for us.
And so how many subscribers? You're up to 3 million today?
We're at 3 million today. And, you know, around 300,000 people have gotten at least one referral. And the rewards that we're giving, like, we're starting to change it up. But historically, it's always been brew swag or access to community or access to exclusive content. Basically, we've always thought from the perspective of the people who are going to refer Morning Brew are our super fans. They're the people who are really passionate about what Morning Brew is up to. What are yeah. the things that they would really care about getting if they refer people? And normally we say it's swag that they can show off in public to social signal, or it's more content from us because they really like our content, or it's access to other super fans like them who they can be in conversation with.
Like a community. Yeah.
Exactly. And so some of our rewards, what it includes is like, I'll just give you a few examples. Morning Brew coffee mugs. Makes a ton of sense for a logo. Also makes a ton of sense because coffee mugs, one of the cheapest items to manufacture. Like a coffee mug is like 10 cents. And so when we think about what is the acquisition cost to get referrals.
10 cents. Now I'm worried that I'm going to die from what's in my coffee mug if it only costs 10 cents.
Ceramic is a very cheap material. And so you'll like coffee mugs, but then you also have things like our Facebook group, which is cost $0. You know, you could assign you could assign some costs, like, you know, the writer on our team who has to do a little bit of work each week to moderate the community, but it's very low, but it gives value to people to connect with other people in the Morning Brew community. You know, we recently moved away from this, but for a long time, it was a Sunday edition of the newsletter was only open to people who got 3 referrals. Again, really cheap. All the only cost of that was the writer who's writing it once a week and whatever the cost was of sending an email.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, you seem to lever on the people that cared, what they cared about, not rewarding them with the wrong incentive.
Just smart about basically what is the best bang for our buck with rewards. Bang meaning the highest impact on our best readers, but at the most efficient cost from an acquisition cost perspective.
But you said something too, I think, that's really important around not making it transactional. So John Rulin, who's been on the podcast, good friend of mine, like the guru of gifting and all things gifting. He says, like, if someone sends you like $100,000 referral, don't necessarily send them something right away. And then a couple months later, send them a nice thank you, a bottle of wine, or this, or like, thanks for having us on your mind, because then it's just a nice thing that you're thanking that. You know, you should always send a thank you note, but the gift is sort of a nice thing for thinking of us. Otherwise, it could be, oh, I sent these guys $100,000 lead and they sent me a $50 bottle of wine. Cheap, you know.
Aspirin. It becomes a reference point, and then someone thinks about that reference point.
Right. Rather than, oh, they just did a nice thing. So he always talks about always thanking people for referrals, but staggering the sort of reward so that it's not transactional, so that you're, again, for the reason that you're saying.
Yeah, it's I don't know if this is the right analogy, but it's very prescient given I have a puppy. It's like puppies have really short memories. If you validate them with like a treat, they associate it with whatever they've just done. But if you give them a treat like 2 minutes later, they're just getting a treat.
Yeah, then you're just friendly.
It seems like the exact same thing.
In 2017, entrepreneur John Rampton was frustrated with the available calendar tools, which led him to create Calendar.com. Calendar.com allows all of your different calendars to come together in one place. It also has some great features that solve many of the common frustration of team calendars. Smart links with notifications ensure you never need to worry about double booking or no-shows. The Find a Time feature compares everyone's schedules at once, finding the optimum time to meet. No more emailing back and forth trying to find out when everyone is free. And you also get analytics that will give you reports that show how you and your team are spending your time, allowing you to be more efficient. If you're looking to make yourself or your team more efficient this year, head over to calendar.com now to start your and see the difference for yourself. That's calendar.com.
So you obviously had huge success with this. And then you and Austin made a decision to sell a majority stake to Business Insider. Yep. Was that a difficult decision, easy decision? How do you know, all the people listening, how do you know when it's time?
Yeah, it's, so first of all, yes, it was a difficult decision.
Were you looking or did they just come to you?
No, we were not looking. We had been in touch with folks from Business Insider for a few years prior to even being in like a deal conversation. And we had been approached about deals a number of times, but never was like the partner, the context, the number, never was it interesting enough for us to sell, because our whole thing was like, our whole ethos was like, why would we sell? You know, we're living the dream right now. Everything we want to accomplish in our careers, we have it right now, you know, building something that helps people, working with really smart people, having access to business leaders we shouldn't have access to, not worrying about money, controlling our own destiny. Like, we had all of those things. And so we weren't actively looking because those are the things we want in our career. Why would we look for something different? We ended up being approached by Insider, and, you know, we were really excited by what they had built. We were really excited by kind of like the complementary nature of their business. We're excited by also just like the financial aspect of it.
Well, you had said before that that was why you did this, right? To try to have that security for your family. And yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, for me, the two big reasons that I think that we did this were, one, Morning Brew has just like evolved so quickly. And as we were making this transition from like newsletter company to media brand to consumer brand, there are so many more moving parts. And to have a partner that has both resources and knowledge to help that seemed like a really good thing to have in your corner, almost like a really good insurance policy for having all these blind spots, because we had never built a media business before. So that was the biggest thing. The other big thing was having a partner who would let us build without getting in the way. That was really important to us. And that was something that we made clear and they made clear very early on. And then the third piece was like, it was a life-changing amount of money that, from my perspective, one, like goes back to kind of what I was telling you before about my own personal desires, but also just in terms of optionality in life, you know, to be in such a privileged and fortunate spot to have some level of financial freedom at 27 years old, my view was like, it would give so much more optionality for the next however many years of my career.
So that's a good segue. I mean, you mentioned your step into the sort of chairman role, obviously still involved, but what you built an incredible foundation. You can now do whatever you want at 27. So do you have a sense for what that next big is, or what the next mountain is at all? No,
no idea. And that kind of, it's like, it's strange. It's definitely anxiety provoking. One, because it's weird to not be intimately involved in the day-to-day of Morning Brew every day. Like, that's weird for me after doing that for 6 years. Like, so much of my identity was tied up in Morning Brew. And so I think even now, even though I'm still obviously very involved in the brew and am doing things from like creating my own podcast and being now almost like a personality within the business, helping with business development on the advertising sales side, helping with things related to culture, it's in a different way. So I think it is strange to kind of just come to terms and become comfortable with like my identity just shifting in this moment. And at the same time, there's, I think, the anxiety of at whatever point in the future, whatever it is, 3, 5, 10 years, I'm no longer involved with Morning Brew. I think there's also just this anxiety that I'll always have about, one, how do I make it so I haven't peaked in life?
Yeah, that is a very common concern. I've seen people make so much money and be so successful, and then they're so worried about not measuring up to their own level of success.
Yeah. So there's one, it's like, how am I not a one-trick pony? Two, how am I going to find something that I'm as passionate about again, right? Like, most people, I haven't realized it, or I'm starting to realize it, but like, most people work to live. Like, they enjoy their job enough
to support their passions.
Morning Brew has been my passion. And that's such a, again, like such a privileged and amazing thing. And so it is a very strange concept to me to think about, beyond Morning Brew, what is my passion going to be? Like, what am I going to get super amped up about? And I don't know the answer to that. The way that I try to answer it is, one, by not putting so much pressure on myself and saying to myself, you know, you're in a really fortunate position where actually like your passion doesn't have to be tied to income if it doesn't want to be. Like, your passion could be golf if that's like what you're really passionate about. But also, like, what I do know is I love learning. I love learning new things. And so where I always go is, rather than forcing myself to have a passion, let me just be a voracious consumer of content online, in book form, in podcast form. Let me just learn. And by kind of like expanding my surface area of learning, so I'm like spending time learning about a bunch of different topics right now, from angel investing to Ethereum to decentralized finance, the future of education, maybe something will stick. And if something doesn't stick, that's okay. I've learned something really interesting.
It sounds like it's your senior year again at Michigan, right?
Where, exactly.
I mean, you need that space to, I mean, you made the conscious decision to step back, right? And so I think that creating that space is what's going to help you figure that out. Look, people always talk about, I've talked to so many entrepreneurs and friends and whatever sold their business. Like, it seems to the rest of the world like it's this beautiful, amazing blessing. And a lot of them are pretty sad and unhappy years later. They haven't figured out what's next. No one wants to hear about that problem, but it is real. There's a real identity tied up into that. It's a hard transition.
Yeah. And I think broadly, just like mental health and well-being and mindfulness in general, in like the startup space, I think we're at a point now where people understand it's important. Yeah. Like, I think it used to be people didn't even have an awareness around its importance. I think today it's been talked about enough that it's like a little cliche to mention it because people understand its importance. But I think there's a difference between people understanding its importance and like practicing it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that transition's been made yet. Like, I think a lot of entrepreneurs and founders understand the importance of finding purpose, finding out what gives you energy, being mindful, having an awareness about yourself and what's around you, but don't actually practice it. They just get that it's important.
That is progress, though. I do think totally. We made huge progress. Like 10 years ago, you had Marissa Mayer and these CEOs bragging about 4 hours of sleep and 130-hour work week. And at least we've come to that's not being celebrated you know, anymore. And you have a lot more CEOs talking about sleep and health. And I mean, I literally remember, you know, her, you know, bragging about that. And obviously the performance of the company was not that great.
Yeah, totally.
Given that. So I agree. We're getting there. I at least it's not, I worked 140 hours this week. Oh, I worked 150 hours this week.
Yeah, totally. It is progress for sure.
So, senior year part two, I'm sure you'll figure it out. So, last question. What's a mistake you made either personally or professionally that you learned the most from? And this can be singular or for a lot of people, it's a repeated recurring one.
I think it is a mistake that I continue to make, but it's a really hard mistake to work yourself out of. So I'm trying to. I think that I still do too much measuring my happiness based off of validation from others. I think, you know, we all as people live on some spectrum, right? Yeah. I don't think any person operates where they are completely isolated from what people think and say, not impacting their emotional state at all. But I think people live on a spectrum. And I think, unfortunately, maybe it's because from building a media company, I've spent a ton of time on social media. Social media is really bad for this. If I talk to my therapist about it, maybe one could argue because I didn't get enough validation from people in middle school and high school. Now I'm looking for it in my later years. Whatever it is, I still think that there is work for me to do in finding fulfillment based on things I do intrinsically, like finding fulfillment based on the thing I learned, finding fulfillment based on a challenge that I solved within the business, not finding fulfillment because I hit 75,000 followers on Twitter. And I think I have not made that full transition yet. It is something I have an awareness around. It is something I'm working on, but I think it is something that is really difficult, especially in the age of your attention being grabbed and manipulated by social platforms.
Yeah, I actually wrote about this a few weeks ago. I said the modern thing is, you know, if the tree falls in the forest and you don't have a picture of it, like, did it actually fall, right? So the ability to walk down a beach and just enjoy a sunset and not have the inclination to be, I should take a picture of this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, getting to a place where you enjoy the sunset for the sunset and for your experience with it and not because Joe Schmo from college gets to see you with the sunset in the background is an incredibly important distinction. I think is really difficult to find, but is so important for our well-being.
Yeah, it is. Speaking of college, I've noticed, you know, these college reveals things now are just, you know, that are staged for Instagram and elaborate with thousands of dollars of merchandise. Again, it is all for extrinsic validation. Yep. We know it's not healthy, but we have a really hard time breaking out of it.
Totally. I totally agree.
Great. So Alex, where can people find out more about you, Morning Brew and podcast?
Yeah. Well, I would just say if you resonate with any of the things I talked about today, I talk about all of that and a lot more on my podcast, Founders Journal. It's 8 to 15 minute episodes, 3 days a week, where I just talk about my journey of building businesses and learning about business. And then on Twitter, if you're a Twitter person, I'm at Business Barista. So would love for you to follow me there.
I love how it's not lost on me that those podcast episodes are within the window that you said you could focus, the amount of minutes that you said you could focus.
Yep, for sure.
All right, Alex, thank you for sharing your story with us. It's an amazing, amazing journey, and I know it's not over yet.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Alex and his work on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. Huge favor to ask, if you enjoyed today's episode or you've been listening to the Elevate podcast in general, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review. Helps new users discover the show. If you're in Apple, all you got to do is scroll down to My Library and click on Elevate and then ratings or review. So thanks again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.